the question of my book is to look at how is it that so many people could be full, so full of good intentions, spend so many much time and so many resources on trying to make a difference, trying to challenge inequity, trying to challenge racism, and yet still not have anything happen.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, I'm Sarita Srivastava. I'm a sociology professor, and I just wrote a book called Are You Calling Me a Racist? Welcome to Sylvia and Me.
Thank you so much for being here today, Sarita. The book, Are You Calling Me a Racist? There's a subtitle, Why We Need to Stop Talking About Race and Start Making Real Anti-Racist Change. There's so much about diversity and organizations and schools are trying to figure out what they should do.
Thank you for joining me today.
And you go
into... If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested.
All conversations about race are weighed down by feel-good racial politics.
This has been a Life of Prey production.
Diversity work should not be therapeutic, educational, or self-reflective. We need to make concrete collective changes to our practices and spaces. What exactly do you mean by that? Because you take a look, so many organizations, in fact, this is very apropos to something I got that I received today on a small New England town, a very wealthy, mainly wealthy town, where all of a sudden, oh, there's anti-racism in the schools. Oh my, not in my school. I mean, you know, we're in America. And so they're trying to figure out what they should do. And, you know, diversity here, diversity there. It really, as you said, you have this feel good. What do you mean by that? Because we do make it individual.
Thank you. There's so much there in your question.
I know. I'm sorry.
I'm going to take the first part of the question.
We'll break it down.
Yeah, let's break it down. So the first part of your question is, what do I mean by feel good racial politics? And in fact, what do I mean by that whole quote that you so kindly took from my book, which is that anti-racist and diversity work shouldn't be therapeutic, self-reflective, or educational. So I want to say, first of all, that I believe in education, therapy, and self-reflection. I want to make that really clear, that those are all important practices that we should all be doing. I'm an educator. I'm a dean of arts and science at a university. So I really profoundly believe in education. My critique of educational approach or the therapeutic or self-reflection, reflective approach is specifically about diversity in organizations. So it doesn't mean that in universities or in schools or in high schools, we shouldn't do deeper educational practices or courses or curricula that are focused on the history of racism, for example, or any manner, anything about relationship to diversity or equity or racism, where we're learning a lot about the current research, the past history, history of colonialism, and so on. Those are all great things to do. And that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is when organizations, public institutions, social movements, schools, corporations say, we would like to do something about the question of diversity or equity. And there's a whole industry attached to that work. Huge industry, like multi-million dollar industry, which says, oh, here's the easiest thing to do is we'll call in a trainer or an educator or a facilitator to come in and do a workshop. So my critique is organized around that, which is asking the question, what happens in those workshops when we say we need training? Is it actually making a difference and an impact to that organization in terms of its practices? So the research shows that most cases that's not happening, that most equity workshops or diversity workshops might lead to a short-term change in attitudes, but it's not even if they do, those changes aren't sustained. So there's not really a change in, and then secondly, it's a change in attitude. It's not a change in how we do things.
Right. So you might- exactly. The whole thing has to be centered around change in attitude. Going to class to learn calculus or algebra is really not going to get you out in the real world. Having somebody tell you that you shouldn't be biased against something and you shouldn't be racist against this person without really pulling in what's going on around them, you know, someone's going to work out and go, okay, you know, I could check that mark off. Now what?
Yes, in fact, as you're saying, sometimes what happens, as research shows, is that people feel, in fact, more emboldened to act in ways that are discriminatory because they've been through the training and they feel quite good about themselves that I've been through the training. I definitely couldn't be sexist when I'm assessing this resume, for example, of who to interview. So therefore, they feel more comfortable in making those discriminatory decisions because they feel quite centered in their own training and their own knowledge of themselves as anti-racist or not sexist or feminist. So there's research that shows all this large amount of money that's spent on workshops and equity workshops doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? That's the question of my book, is to look at how is it that so many people could be so full of good intentions, spend so much time and so many resources on trying to make a difference, trying to challenge inequity, trying to challenge racism, and yet still not have anything happen. So this is why, by the way, I think this, I'm going to take the question separately, then your second question of the schools and the resistance, because really the most of my book is looking at places, not where people are saying, we don't want to do that anti-racism thing, we don't believe racism exists, but actually in places where people have really good intentions, where they're already committed. And yet, even despite their good intentions, their good commitments, their time and energy, the outcomes are not good. So really what I look at is this contradiction between good intentions and energy spent and weak outcomes. And that's it's in that place. So why is that happening? So this concept of feel-good racial politics, I use that phrase simply because it's a catchy phrase, but to highlight that so often much of the work that we do is about feeling good, which is that we want to feel that we are good people, feel that we're moral and upright and upstanding, we're good activists, we're progressive. So if it's happening inside a social movement organization, we all know that we're equitable and focused on social justice. If it's happening in a school, we all know that we believe in equality and equity. So we feel good about ourselves as good people. And then we also want to feel good. Like we want to feel that we're helping other people. We want to feel that we want to feel comfortable. We want to feel psychically comfortable and good. So so when someone calls you a racist, for example, then all of a sudden it's a very deep place of discomfort. And so that's related to the first part, which is what you want to feel like you're a good person, and anything to do with racism is automatically considered something that must be speaking to some deep evil, because it's always centered on the individual. So all these conversations about race are centered on individuals feeling that they're good people and feeling good rather than on the organizational practices.
So how do we move from that individual? Because as you said, it's an emotional thing that most people feel. They don't want to be called a racist. I mean, oh my word, it could be for them the worst thing ever. They think they are, you know, they love everyone. There's no one who's better than they are. You know, everyone's the same. How do you go from breaking that down to really having an organization or a school system get away from that emotional individual feeling?
So I think the first step is to actually decouple this idea that racism is about something that lives in the individual. So, excuse me, I have to...
Bless you.
Let me start again. I think the first thing is we have to decouple this idea that racism is about the individual and that lives in the individual. And that if racism is something about an individual being a bad person, because if racism is about being a bad person, then the only people that are a problem are people who are bad folks that are not, definitely not what, you know, me. And the only way to fix that would be to educate them to be better, to put them through therapy so that they look deeply inside themselves and realize that they're terrible people or wrong and so on. And while all this therapy is going on and all this re-education is going on, the organization is still doing things the way that it always was. And we're focused on this very long process, which is an important process for all of us to undertake. I'm not against that self-reflection therapeutic work that we can all do in relationship to the difficult things in our lives, which include racism and include sexism and so on, and all that exists in our family. So that's important work. Keep doing it. But inside your workplace, inside your organization, that work is not the place, that is not the place for that kind of individual therapeutic work. That in the workplace, the organizations, what we need to be doing is to be looking at our practices. How is it that we are doing things? So I think that, so to go back to your original question, how do we get away from this this individualistic, therapeutic, self-reflective workshop approach? The first step is for everyone to acknowledge that the work we are doing is not on the individuals and the interior lives. It does not involve introspection, but involves looking outward. So that's why the title of the book is "Are You Calling Me a Racist?" is to highlight, to get people to understand that that reaction, where you take it as an individual critique rather than a societal critique or a structural critique or an organizational critique, is where the problem begins. So if we can first get away from that, and then second, in our workshops, actually do the work of saying, so where do we want to be going? What's our vision of what kind of organization we want to be? What is it we're trying to do? Do we want to serve a diverse group of people? Do we want to create products that reflect our community? Do we want to change the world? Do we want to educate students to be able to deal with the diversity in the world? Do we want them to actually be challenging racism? What's our vision? And that will be different. That answer will be different for every organization. So my book doesn't give a one size fits all, like here's the three steps you will do and then you will be an anti-racist organization, except to say that everyone has to understand where is it that they're going? What are the practices in their organization that are preventing them from getting there? And then pick a place to act, pick three places and where, and they could be small places where we can intervene in those practices that are preventing us from getting to that vision. So that could be as simple as our hiring practices, as it could be as simple as what products are we offering? What services are we offering to our community? It will be different for every organization.
Well, that's the thing. And when, you know, when these workshops come in, they don't look at the actual organization. They have a booklet that is supposed to be a, you know, one for all. And they just use it over and over and over again, maybe tweaking depending upon whether they need to have more females in there. They need to have older people. They need to have people of color. They need to, you know, and that's usually about the only thing that they change, you know, whether it be sex education, you know, and sexual harassment education or bias education. If you took the manuals, they would all look alike with a couple of changes of some of the wording.
Yeah.
So you have, so instead of individual, you say there's three directions for equity work that offer promise. And one of them is what you talked about, concrete practice. And you just spoke about focusing on analyzing, you know, the actual, what they do, what they're looking to do. Another one is you call ethical and effective shift. What can you describe what you're talking about there?
So this is the deeper work that we do as individuals and in community. So that's the work that I think in most cases belongs outside of our everyday practices of organizations. So if we're a community organization or people running a university, the ethical and affective shift is something that's long-term as a society or long-term as an organization. It doesn't mean we can't do it. So an example of an ethical shift, for example, is in a university where we say, let's look at our academic and strategic plan. And this is what we did in our university. and to say, as a community, let's say, what are the values as a whole we want to be working on for the next 5 years or forever? And in our university, one of our key goals is decolonization. You know, we have a history of colonialism in relationship to Indigenous people, the history of residential schools. And so dealing with the impact of colonization and the impact of residential schools is something that's deeply important in Canada and in the university that I work for. So to me, that's an ethical shift. It's an ethical shift we're doing collectively as a community. It's not necessarily an individual ethical shift, but that can be, those two things can be related. That's something on which it's a bigger picture. It's also an organizational change, but it's simply a policy. But but I think as a society or a community, it can be more than a policy. It can actually be that we are shifting our relationship to how we think about others in our community, how we think about questions of equity or equality or justice, or how we want to live with others in our community, or how we want to think about what kind of difference we make in the world. And then that would then translate into how we educate our students and our children, our university students. And the affective is the emotional. So to say, what I want to say is that even though I critique the use of the feel-good racial politics and the focus on the moral and the emotional in the workplace organizational space, I still recognize that on a societal level, that is the bigger picture work that we have to do. That is how abolition came about in the US. The abolitionists really felt a relationship to their own religious commitments and said, we see slavery as wrong. We see it as a sin. We see it as, you know, immoral. And therefore, we are going to work, you know, sacrifice all kinds of our livelihoods, our well-being to work for the abolition of slavery. It was a profound ethical shift, not as individuals, but in religious communities, and eventually in the U.S. as a whole, to see slavery as wrong, and therefore something that individuals can act on. It's a different relationship to concepts of what is wrong and right. And then there, you know, and the affective part is to change the emotional relationship to that. To feel that this not only is wrong, but it's something that we feel passionately about, that affects our emotions, there is some relationship of also how is it that our affective relationship changes to those people whom they've enslaved. So that relation, the ethical and emotional relationship change in a societal level through changes in how people thought about religion and religious communities, to changes in how people thought in general about what was right and just and what was moral. So those are also important big changes. It's just not changes that that make sense for an organization to do in a workshop. So I want to recognize it's not the only way to make change.
No, I understand that, but it's almost like the two somehow need to come together, because you can do something in an organization and it's only meant for that organization, and no one's taking that out of that workshop and you know, 5 o'clock, ding, ding, they're going home now. And now they're in the community and they're not taking, there's no correlation for them.
Yeah.
Because they've forgotten what, you know, that was only at their workplace. And now they are, you know, at home with their children, or they're out in the community. Yeah, so it, you know, it has to somehow, to me, be integrated. Yes, it's great to be able to say, you know, this organization is diverse, and there's, you know, there's no one there that you could call a racist, because they've done this, this, and this, and they've really looked into everything, and they're doing things the way they perceive they're supposed to be. But if an individual doesn't take that outside with them, at some point, something's not going to click.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my point there is I don't have the answers, but I'll say that here's the areas in which we can make change. And some of the ethical affective work has been going on for a couple hundred years, let's say 150 years already. And so we have a good foundation of understanding how and where. We've already done a lot of that work, I would say, and we can continue to do that work out in our communities and in our families and in our personal relationships. But even if we continue to do that work and we didn't change the structure of our organizations and practices of our organizations, that also wouldn't be enough. It has to be, as you say, both together. So I think the important piece to me is that work is ongoing. It's been going on for a couple hundred years and it's going to keep going. And it's going to continue, but we can't wait for the work to be finished. We can't wait till we change the hearts and minds of everybody before we start changing the organizations. It would be like saying, we want everyone to believe that desegregating schools is a good idea before we change the law. We still are going to be doing the work in the community to create good community relationships among all those people who went and picketed those school kids who were trying to go to school once schools were desegregated. And that work event, you know, continued. But in the meantime, we're going to say this practice needs to change because it's wrong. And that's the relationship I see between the two things, is both have to be happening at the same time.
I totally agree. What do you hope that someone reading your book, what is the most important thing that you'd like them to get out of it?
Really, it's very simple, and I see it every day in my organization, is to move from this idea that we can fix problems by more training. It's always more training, and training is not education. It's take a workshop, do a short-term thing. We need someone to come in and talk to you for 2 hours, or you need to do this module online, and that's the source of the problem. When often the solution is much simpler than that. It's not to say that the person shouldn't take a training or module, but the problem is that gets seen as the fix, and the period is at the end of that training, and people feel that their duty has been done. Whereas instead of analyzing, why did this thing happen in the first place, where someone felt, someone was put in this position of having to make a decision that made someone else feel discriminated against. Let's say it's a student looking for services, and they get asked a particular kind of question that they probably shouldn't be asked before they get to access services. Well, we could simply change a policy and say, this is how students access services. They shouldn't have to jump through these hoops and prove, whether they're poor enough or this enough in order to get access to this particular service. They shouldn't have to answer personal questions in order to get accommodation for their, for neurodiversity, et cetera. They should be able to do it here and not have to do it with this person at the desk. There should be a separate confidential process, something like that. There's some very simple, straightforward processes and practices. Instead of going, that person said something to that person that was ableist, and that person now needs to go into training. That may be the case, but that's probably still not going to fix the problem, because it only is that person that's getting the training. It's not actually changing the relationship of the student who's going in to get the services, to say, actually, we should be thinking about how are we exposing the student to having to prove who they are and who they and themselves. It's just one example. The example I give in the book is a Starbucks example of two men going in, ordering a coffee. By the time their friend has got there for the business meeting, they're in handcuffs and being arrested. And Starbucks sent their employees out for an afternoon. $12 million it costs them to do an afternoon of training. Not that training is bad, but would that have fixed the problem if that employee had the training before they called the police? Probably not, because they still would have said, why isn't that person ordering it? Why aren't they ordering coffees? You're supposed to order coffee. I asked them to order coffee. They didn't. And they went to other place, which that was nothing to do about what they learned in the training, which is the experience of, people who have experienced racism, because they see that as something else. And they see those people as a problem because they didn't order coffee. And so a very simple strategy is to say, don't arrest people who come in and order coffee. It's really, really simple. No matter what they look like, it could be a really straightforward protocol. If someone comes in and doesn't order coffee, here's step number one. Step number two, if it escalates and you still think they should be ordering coffee, you could do X, talk to your manager. Here's a de-escalation process. You don't call the police until X happens. Somebody is physically threatening. There's something to customers or to you. There's like a very straightforward way that this could be dealt with without having to put everyone, but to say you did anti-racist training looks like you were directing it against the problem of racism, which was, somehow that looks like it's a more fulsome response to the problem of racism than to say we changed our policy so that you can sit in a Starbucks without ordering coffee, which they also did. But if they'd just done that, people would have said they're not taking racism seriously because they're not doing the training and they should do the training. So it's, I think we need to shift. You asked me the question, what's the number one thing I would like people to take away, is to ask yourself first, is there some other way that I can solve this problem besides training? Is there something in the way that we are doing things that we could change that would have prevented this thing that we're addressing from happening in the first place?
And if we look at life, that's really how we should be approaching just about everything we do when we run up against something. Sarita, where can people find out more about you?
Well, I am, as I said, a dean of the Faculty of Arts and Science at OCAD University, which is the biggest art and design school in Canada, so in Toronto. So you can go on the OCAD University website. I'm there. I also have a page on academia.edu, I think it's called. And there's another one, Google Scholar. So that has all my articles on there. You can look and see. And of course, you can go on Amazon or NYU Press website and find out more about my book, Are You Calling Me a Racist? And purchase it from them as well. But thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
I want to thank you so much. This is a conversation that needs to continue and continue on a very broad basis. And get some things changed, not just with diversity training and a workshop.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to do just that.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.